Right. Good morning, everyone, and good morning to those on the phone. I'm Rodney Cook, Group CEO Designate of the JRP Group. For those of you who are on the phone, I'm joined this morning by our CFO Designate, Simon Thomas, and our Deputy CEO Designate, David Richardson. And might I also make a special welcome to our Chairman Designate, Chris Gibson-Smith, who is with us today. Thank you. Thank you also to Nomura for the use of their conference facilities once again this morning, and welcome to those everywhere joining us. We do appreciate your continued interest in our companies. Before turning to the agenda, may I start by making it clear that today we are presenting interim results for Just Retirement and full-year results for Partnership. And given the current status of our proposed merger, which I will update you on later, we are actually legally precluded from presenting any pro forma information as if the companies were actually combined. So sorry about that. Can I now turn to today's agenda? As usual, I'll give you a brief update on the exciting events we've experienced over the last year. Simon will take you through Just Retirement's numbers in more detail, and David will take you through Partnership's results for the year. And following that, I'd like to share with you some perspectives on the future, and we will leave time for your questions, although note we are presenting two full companies today rather than just one. Importantly, perhaps almost for the last time, please allow me to remind you that in the case of Just Retirement, we have a 30th of June financial year end. And on this point, I'm pleased to confirm that we have listened to your views. Where's Andrew? Thank you. The recommendation is to change to a December financial year end once the merger is completed. Now, that will mean that in March of 2017, we will be presenting to you a report for the 18-month accounting period ending in December 2016. And thereafter, we will present on a calendar year basis, like other companies, life companies in the UK. And I do trust that that will make it slightly easier for all of us. For the purposes of today, we have actually anticipated that change, and we have calendarized the results where possible in the documents you have before you. But as ever, we will try and highlight clearly where we are talking about different accounting periods. Moving swiftly to some highlights. Of course, the last 6 months have continued to deliver very significant change for the environment in which we operate, and of course, the impact on our business. We have nevertheless delivered some very positive results, and we are optimistic about our future prospects. But first, both of our companies, which are coming together as JRP, have delivered good results in 2015. And I'm particularly proud that Just Retirement's actually signing off with its record year of sales and profits. I'll look to the highlights for Just Retirement in a moment, but I need not remind you that the regulatory environment in the UK has been transformed completely over the last 6 months. Just Retirement has now received approvals for both its internal model and its Solvency II matching adjustment. And although this new regulatory environment results in a very conservative view of capital requirements, especially as you'll see later compared with our own economic capital models, we are comfortable with our Solvency II positions, particularly given that we have strong Tier 1 balance sheet position and very low debt leverage at the group level of the combined entity and none in the case of Just Retirement. And that bodes well for the merged group and its future growth prospects. Now to the merger. As you know, yesterday we announced that both the Prudential Regulation Authority and the Financial Conduct Authority have both approved the change in control. And of course, that had followed from the Competition and Authority's approval late last year. So we expect now to be in a position to complete the merger early in April 2016. I will come back to the timetable a little later on. I would like to remind you all that we now remain confident with respect to the prospect of delivering for our shareholders the substantial increase in value from achieving at least $40 million of annual cost savings, with that full run rate being achieved in 2018. Now, the results that you will see have been achieved through the very hard work of engaged and talented people in both of our companies. The evidence of that is really quite clear, and if I could draw that to your attention. Both of our companies received, once again, five-star service awards from the financial advisor community. In Just Retirement, we achieved our sixth entry in the Sunday Times Best 100 Companies to Work For in the UK. But to top it off, and this is quite unusual for a financial services organisation, to top that off, Just Retirement last week was awarded the coveted 2016 UK Quality Service Provider Award from the Institute of Customer Service. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is against all brands in all industries, not just financial services, where often people would say it's not a difficult benchmark. Now, given the huge changes we have seen, before I move on to the figures, I'd like to just remind you about our two important markets and why we find both of them attractive. So, firstly, to defined benefit de-risking, where we think the market opportunity is huge. According to the latest Pensions Purple Book, the DB industry, as you see in the chart, is managing around 2.1 trillion of liabilities, and judging from the fact that only 13% and declining schemes are actually open to new members in the UK, we believe that over time the vast majority of that 2.1 trillion will look to de-risk their liabilities. Medical underwriting for DB schemes made up 15% of the total de-risking activity for schemes of less than 100 million in size, according to the Pensions Institute. And that suggests to us significant future scope for growth in the smaller market. But can I remind you that is not the only place that our companies participate, and at the larger end, we help by top slicing schemes, and here we medically underwrite the largest individual liabilities, and employee benefit consultants are increasingly receptive to this method, given that it can generate superior outcomes for their clients overall. A number of you have rightly pointed out that predicting the future size on a year-by-year basis of the defined benefit de-risking market is a mug's game. But what I have shown here is a range of external third-party predictions, admittedly quite broad, between 10 and 25 billion per annum over the next 5 years. Who knows what the answer will actually be? But I put it to you, even at the top end of that range, at the 20 billion level, that represents a mere 1% per annum of the 2 trillion of liabilities. So perhaps 100 years of effort stored up there. So I think that over time that is conservative. So that's why we're optimistic about our participation in defined benefit de-risking, which, as you will see from the numbers, is our largest sales proposition. Now turning to the guaranteed income for life market, GIFL, I think we can once again make a strong positive investment case for participation in individually underwritten GIFLs. The market contraction, as you see on the slide, in all forms of GIFL in the first half of 2015 has come to a conclusion, and we are seeing evidence of growth and improvement in the second half. Of course, given where we are, it is early days, but it's good to see those sales increasing again, and both companies had improved sales positions in the second half of 2015. Can I remind you the underlying dynamics in this market, the long-standing drivers of the ageing UK demographic, the continuing defined benefit to defined contribution trend, and so on. Logically, we expect medium to longer term growth in the GIFL market. We intend to continue to be active in this market, and we are reviewing developments, particularly those from the FCA, with real interest. Indeed, the dynamics of this market have significantly changed, and if you see on the slide in terms of the open market proportion, they've actually moved against the intended regulatory direction of travel. And we believe when that corrects, we, JRP, should benefit. So although it is great to see that nearly three quarters, as shown on the graph there, three quarters of the open market is being now medically underwritten, the level of open market penetration falling from 60% to around 40% is against market expectations, and we do believe that regulatory intervention to encourage people to shop around for a better deal should reverse that trend. I've talked before about the underlying growth drivers in our business, and they are quite straightforward, actually. So if we grow our sales and we grow our total liabilities, then surely new business profit and in-force profits will follow. Our top line success on the left-hand side means that this growth dynamic is firmly in place, and other things being equal, new business profit will follow. But perhaps drawing more attention, if I could, to the left-hand chart. Sales growth, sure, has begun its recovery, and the two previous slides on our marketplaces will explain, I believe, why we feel that sales should continue to grow in the medium term. From that right-hand chart, however, the dark blue lines are the cash inflows, and you can see that they have significantly exceeded the outflows, which are the gold below the line bars. Currently, inflows are more than double our outflows, and the total liabilities under management is actually a major profit driver. So, in fact, our net liability inflow are running at over 10% of opening liabilities over the last 18 months. And I put it to you, that indicates we have a clearly growing business. So, last slide before handing over to Simon, I wanted to show you our usual highlights from the last 6 months of trading. Total retirement sales and in mortgages in the second half grew by approximately 50%. The jump in retirement sales, of course, delivered by almost a doubling of defined benefit sales and a 2% increase, as I mentioned, in GIFL sales. The final quarter of 2015 was comfortably our record quarter, but more particularly now that you've encouraged us to calendarise our presentations, you will see that calendar 2015 is indeed a record for both sales and profits in our company's 11-year history. So I think I can just reinforce that point, that in 2015, the same year that the famous pension freedoms came into force, we have achieved a record both in sales and profit for our organization. Now, fortunately, I cannot exactly remember who of you in this room claimed in March of 2014 that our companies were effectively closed to new business. But I think we're putting evidence on the table to show that we are not closed to new business. So in the center of the chart, strong top-line growth is replicated by the profit story, and the interim underlying operating profit shown here grew by 53%. So I'd finish my remarks on this slide by recording that we have now reached a record embedded value for the organisation of $1,144,000,000, which represents around £2.03 per share. So, Simon, can I hand over, please, to you to take the audience through the financials in more detail?
Thanks, Rodney. I'm going to take you through the numbers for Just Retirement, and then I'll hand over to David to do the same for Partnership. So let's move straight to the IFRS profit and loss account. As Rodney has already said, underlying operating profit rose by a robust 53% to $65 million in the 6 months to December. This impressive increase was driven by a more than doubling of new business profit, slightly offset by a lower level of in-force profit. The 153% increase in new business profit to $46 million is the principal driver of all of this. New business profit was obviously helped by the 51% increase in total retirement sales, but margins also improved significantly from 2.9% to 4.7%. And as usual, I'll explain that more in a moment. The decline in in-force profit to $19 million is at odds with the increase in opening liabilities, and has been driven by a change to the way we recognize the benefit of the mortgages. I'll come back to this, but let me be absolutely clear. This doesn't change the expected benefit and yield over the life of the mortgage at all. Below the underlying operating profit, we saw some small negative noise in operating variances and group company results, and reinsurance and bank finance fees dropped slightly as a result of the lower proportion of the book being reinsured. So our pre-tax operating profit has risen by an eye-catching 43% to £50 million. Below the operating profit line, we've seen lower non-recurring and project expenditure. This line includes continued investment in Solvency II costs, which are hopefully at an end or getting towards an end, and costs associated with the development of our drawdown product. Investment and economic profits and losses are slightly positive in this period as a result of credit spread widening being offset by yields captured on investments being higher than expected. And below that line, we highlight the merger cost incurred to date of some £16 million, and this relates mainly to banker and advisory costs. I won't comment too much on the calendarized figures on the right-hand side of the page in detail, except to say that underlying operating profit for the calendar year 2015 of $109 million was up a useful 18%, and operating profit was up by 9% at £83 million. I think these are respectable results in the year immediately following the pension freedoms. Now, looking at the top line in more detail, Rodney's already used up most of the superlatives to describe the sales performance in the last 6 months. Our DB sales grew by a remarkable 98% to just over $700 million in the half year, and I'll look at this in more detail in a moment. Now, although it's exciting to see the exponential growth of a new division, after our challenges in the GIFL market, it feels like demand for the GIFL product is improving. This stability, together with our very disciplined pricing stance, means that volumes generated in the 6 months to June 15 are a reasonable starting point for expectations for the first 6 months to June 16 for Just Retirement. In relation to the mortgages, we took full advantage of the surge in retirement income funding to tap the strength of mortgage demand, or the strength in mortgage demand, with an increase in advances of 49%, up to £237 million. And given attractive pricing in mortgages, this has obviously done no harm to our overall margins. Now, I'll just talk a little bit more about DB. As we're always saying, DB is a lumpy business, and the 98% increase that we're reporting on today is a case in point. The final quarter had a double benefit of the normal seasonal effect and some EBCs suggesting that schemes should transact before Solvency II was implemented. Lumpy though it is, with a bit of averaging, you can still see a growing trend. The gold bars on the chart plot the trailing average sales per quarter, which continue to rise nicely. Likewise, every quarter of calendar 2015 was meaningfully higher than every corresponding quarter of calendar 2014. Looking ahead, you might recall in September that we guided you towards our DB sales trending around 200 to 300 million for the 6 months to June 2016. Now, given the acceleration in business into the December quarter to beat the Solvency II rules, Q1 has started very quietly for DB. However, we're still maintaining the guidance for Just Retirement, but I would expect this to be heavily skewed towards Q2. Now, turning to new business margins. New business margins recovered during the 6 months of December, which together with the jump in volumes drove a more than doubling of new business profit to £46 million. The margin expansion, as usual, doesn't reflect one single item, but a combination of factors. The first is the much higher weighting of the DB business in this half versus last year. And that's relevant because DB's seen higher margins over the last 18 months than our individual business. And you'll remember that individual business has seen a lower margin, mainly as a result of the increased competition in the GIFL segment, which was obviously reduced in size after the budget changes. DB also benefits from the closer durational match between the liabilities and our mortgage assets, and that's helpful. Secondly, as I mentioned earlier, the mortgage yields themselves were also very healthy in the second half of 2015, boosting margins further. A third factor is the fact that we wrote 50% more business in this half, so that has naturally led to an element of operational leverage. I should also note that calendar 2015 also benefited from a full year's impact of the cost savings we achieved in calendar 2014. And finally, a small part of the margin improvement was driven by the changes in accounting and presentation that I'll explain in a moment. Looking ahead to our next half year to June, there are a number of factors affecting the outlook. On the positive side, although the GIFL market was more competitive post the pension reforms, we saw widespread price increases towards the end of calendar 2015 as the Solvency II regime loomed. However, I'd expect mortgage yields to fall slightly as a result of the competitive pressures in the market, and obviously a further drag on this next half year is the fact that, as I've already indicated, we'd expect lower volumes in the 6 months to June, so we'll lose some of that operational leverage benefit. Net-net, I'd expect Just Retirement's margins to soften back into the mid-3% for the 6 months to June 2016. Now, looking at the in-force margins, the 21% decline in in-force profit to £19 million is rather at odds with the increase in the opening liabilities and requires a little bit more explanation. With the implementation of Solvency II, we've chosen to create a consistent valuation methodology for our mortgages across all our accounting methods. Previously, mortgages were valued using a different approach under IFRS, UK GAAP, Pillar 1, and Pillar 2. We've now centred the mortgage valuation around the IFRS basis, starting by valuing the loan at the amount initially advanced. And importantly, Solvency II will also follow this IFRS basis. Previously, for in-force profits, we adopted a methodology that recognised the mortgage return broadly on a straight-line basis over a 20-year period. However, we've chosen to recognize the growth in asset value in parallel with the growth in liabilities as they unwind. In other words, it's more of a compounding shape rather than a straight line for both the assets and the liabilities. We continue to achieve very attractive returns on the amounts advanced, but we'll recognize those returns over a slightly longer period, which is more closely linked to the growth in the liabilities. I want to highlight that this doesn't change the overall economic return on the mortgage, but so far as in-force profits are concerned, it does slightly delay the profit recognition, dampening the mortgage return in the in-force. All the other in-force elements are as they were before, so for corporate bonds, mortality, surplus assets and expenses. And going forward, the relationship between liabilities and in-force profit should hold good. Recent bond spread widening may give our spreads a little lift, but for now, an in-force margin of the low 50 basis points of opening liabilities looks sustainable. The flip side of this change, however, is the small uplift in new business that I mentioned just now. It isn't quite equal and opposite, although total profits are broadly unaffected by this largely presentational change. In effect, new business profits were being computed by reference to the average mortgage yield across the whole book. Now, they more realistically reflect a prudent expected yield, adjusted for the NEG, of course, being achieved by the mortgages at a similar time to when the premiums were written. Now, given that mortgage rates are slightly higher than historic averages, this results in a fall in the in-force margin and a commensurate modest boost to the new business profit that I referred to earlier. Turning to another of our KPIs, embedded value. Here the story is also very positive. The embedded value per share was around 203p. This represents an annualized growth rate of 11% before the effects of dividends, merger costs, and capital raising. Here we saw a strong increase in our post-tax new business profit, up 45% to £71 million, being driven by very similar factors to the IFRS new business profit. I think a double-digit underlying EV growth rate suggests we're delivering significant value for our shareholders. Now, moving on to dividend and capital metrics. The directors are proposing an unchanged first interim dividend of 1.1p per share. I'd flag that the current JRG dividend policy is unchanged and that JRP will inherit this policy. Our capital position remains strong on an economic capital basis, which remains our principal capital metric. Our coverage ratio of 180% remains well above our 140% internal target. For the first time, we're reporting our Solvency II figure for the 31st December 2015, even though the regime only technically started on the next day. Obviously, we were delighted to get the matching adjustment and internal model approval after many years of hard work. The JR board is comfortable with JRG's 133% ratio, particularly given the conservatism in the calculation, its relative resilience to the various stress scenarios, and importantly, the very low level of gearing in the business. And I'll come back to that later. Just to note that JRL's capital would have been around 140% at the end of December if the placing proceeds had been injected by that point. Now, just to look at the Solvency II components in more detail, here you can see that we set out the Solvency II elements for Just Retirement. As you can see, we had a Solvency II ratio of 133% for JRG, comprising own funds of around 1.1 billion and an SCR of 0.8 of a billion, giving surpluses at the end of the year of 265 million. Just to remind you, we are one of the 19 companies in the UK with an internal model, and we've adopted both the matching adjustment and the transitional measures. Now, for those of you who are keen to compare companies, it's important to note that Just Retirement Group's own funds are made up of solely Tier 1 capital. We have no Tier 2 capital in our group balance sheet at 31st December 2015. But if we held a more normal market level of gearing at, say, 25 to 30%, it would push Just Retirement Group's prospective ratio from the 130s towards the 170s. You may also remember we stated last year that we might look at the debt capital markets. This remains on the agenda at some point, together with other capital management tools such as reinsurance and hedging. And finally from me, here you can see some of the sensitivities of our Solvency II balance sheet to the various stressed scenarios. As you can see from the chart, the position is relatively insensitive overall, which again gives us confidence in our capital position. The most sensitive stress is, unsurprisingly, to longevity, where a 5% increase in longevity reduces the surplus capital by around £100 million. Now, just to put this into perspective, this level of change would represent a major shift in longevity. Longevity rates typically change only very slowly and do not tend to move by large-scale changes in the short term. Also, I should note that a decrease in longevity would move the ratio clearly in the opposite direction, and recent CMI data in 2015 could suggest a more balanced risk profile for longevity moving forward. In terms of mitigation, we had already taken action. So for individual new business, we have a full risk transfer treaty with SCOR that has been operative over the last year, and on all our DB business, we've always reinsured about 55% of the business with RGA. Both of these treaties will gradually reduce our longevity sensitivity over time as more and more new years come into their scope. As I mentioned earlier, we may also choose to take advantage of the reinsurance markets to reduce the exposure in the back book and look to see what opportunities there are for a combined GIRP group. Our balance sheet is also sensitive to the property stresses. And here I'd say that in advance of the outcome of the PRA's review of mortgages, our board has chosen to adopt a very prudent approach in relation to our property assumptions. The capital requirement for properties now represents about 10% of the face value of the mortgages, and we also deduct an additional similar amount in relation to the no-neg allowance within the liabilities. So we're making a total of allowance of about 20% of the face value of the mortgage, and that's despite a loan-to-value ratio for the book being only at 26%. So it's prudent. Naturally, we'll update our models once the PRA finalise their review. In relation to the other stresses, we're relatively insensitive. Interest rates down does have a negative effect, but our sensitivity is unexceptional in the context of the sector. And credit spreads are not that damaging to our overall capital position. And for the avoidance of doubt, equity shocks are broadly irrelevant to our business. With that, I'll hand over to David to now talk you through the partnership results. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to run through the partnership results now, starting with some highlights. We generated sales of £631 million, with a particularly strong second half, and have delivered on a diversification strategy, which we've previously spoken about. Individual annuity sales increased by 20% in the second half of the year compared to the first half, and bulk annuities increased by 12% over the full year compared to 2014, and comprised approximately 45% of total sales in 2015. The new business margin was 1.7% in 2015, and increased from a small loss of 1% in the first half of the year to a margin of 3.3% in the second half of the year, reflecting those strong second half sales, continued pricing discipline, and demonstrating the real operational leverage of the business. We beat our operating expenses target by 8%, bringing the cost base down to £69 million. The cost cutting achieved during the period gives me confidence in the ability of the combined group to deliver the expense synergy targets that we've previously communicated. And we've also reported a Solvency II ratio of 144%, which is resilient under stress conditions, a relatively low level of gearing, a conservative and well-balanced asset portfolio, and market-consistent embedded value of 144 pence per share. During the year, we also launched our enhanced retirement account, which received overwhelmingly positive customer feedback. And we've also announced our agreement to launch a care annuity in the US market with our US partner, Genworth. So I'm pleased to report a good year both in terms of financial terms and operational delivery. Let me take you through those in a bit more detail, starting with sales. As I mentioned, we had a good second half to the year, both in terms of individual and bulk sales. In total, £631 million of sales over the full year. On the graph on the right-hand side, you can see that, as expected, activity in the individual annuity market hit their low point in the run-in to pensions freedoms coming into force in April of 2015. That was as a result of advisors and customers deferring decision-making. But from that point, we started to see a gradual improvement in sales. Sales of individual annuities increased, as I mentioned, by almost 20% in the second half of the year compared to the first half. This was boosted, I think, to some extent by deferrals unwinding post the changes being implemented. So looking ahead to 2016, at this point in time, I don't expect the run rate on individual annuities to exceed what we saw during the second half of 2015. I think, as we've all mentioned repeatedly, bulk annuities remain lumpy quarter on quarter, but we did see sales accelerating in Q4, which is not unusual in this market. As already mentioned, we think that was also enhanced and accelerated by the impending implementation of Solvency II, which led to some EBCs encouraging their clients to complete transactions in calendar year 2015. Care sales totaled £68 million for the year, slightly down in 2014, but sales returned to their historic run rates in the second half of 2015, which gives me confidence about the medium-term outlook for this product. And finally, although not shown on the slide here, we invested £219 million in new equity release assets. Of that, approximately 20% was through bulk transactions, and the remainder was flow business. So I'd like to look at the DB sales in a bit more detail. As I mentioned, they increased by 12% in the calendar year compared to the prior year. And as we can see in the graphs here, Q4 is traditionally a busy quarter, as we flagged at the time of the Q3 statement in November. And we think that was pronounced this year, as I mentioned, due to the impending introduction of Solvency II. However, I think there's a few things worth highlighting in the performance during the year. Firstly, the £277 million of sales were spread over 15 transactions with an average size of £18 million. If you compare that to 2014, where there were just six transactions and over 80% of our sales were concentrated in one large top slicing transaction, which completed in Q4 of that year. Secondly, and as Rodney has already mentioned, we estimate that roughly 15% of total sub-£100 million de-risking transactions were medically underwritten in 2015. That was building on 10% in 2014 and 3% in 2013. So that demonstrates the real progress we have in developing this market from scratch in 3 years. Excuse me. Looking ahead, as Rodney mentioned, with some very big numbers, there is material untapped potential in this market. However, in the very short term, I expect DB sales are likely to be subdued in the first half of 2016, given the acceleration of sales that we saw in Q4 of last year. Moving on to costs, on this page we set out the progress we've made on the partnership expense base over the past few years. We set an operating expenses target of £75 million and an absolute reduction of £3 million from the 2014 level. By carefully managing costs right across the business, we significantly beat this target, bringing operating expenses down to £69 million for the full year, or equivalently 8% lower than our target. Both Just Retirement and Partnership have taken action on costs in recent years, and our experience through these exercises means we are well placed to achieve the at least £40 million expense synergy target that we've previously communicated when we bring the two businesses together. Now, looking at profits, we've got the new business profits here, which were a total of £11 million for the year, representing a margin of 1.7% of sales. As you can see in both graphs, that was very much skewed to the second half of the year, with the new business margin increasing from a small loss of 1% in the first half of the year to a 3.3% profit margin in the second half of the year. This reflects a strong sales performance in the second half of the year, which, when combined with our pricing discipline, feeds through into positive operational leverage of the business. With sales almost doubling in the second half on a relatively fixed cost base, you can see how the benefit of increasing sales flows directly through to the new business margin. And once we start to see the synergies being delivered when we bring the two companies together, you can expect a significant proportion of those savings to directly benefit the new business margin in the same way. Looking at profits on the in-force book, we generated a total return on surplus assets of £14 million, which represents a yield of 2.8%. As we previously guided, this is lower than the 4% achieved in 2014, which benefited from some higher yielding equity release assets being used to back surplus. During 2015, the underlying performance of the in-force book of £19 million improved from 2014 due to a couple of factors. First of all, we achieved a higher planned mortality margin because of the higher proportion of longevity risk we chose to retain on DB business. And secondly, there was some positive mortality experience during the year, particularly on our care business. In addition, we recognized £4 million of adverse non-recurring assumption changes. Now, looking at the below-the-line items, in total, we generated £40 million of operating profits and a loss after tax for the year of £14 million. I'll step through the key items which bridge between those. We recognised £26 million of adverse investment variances. This was primarily driven from rebalancing of the corporate bond portfolio in advance of Solvency II. This was required in order to optimise our matching adjustment position under the new Solvency II regime. We also incurred a total of £23 million of other non-recurring items. This included £13 million of expenses covering activities relating to new business development and finalising our preparations for Solvency II. There was a further £6 million of transaction costs relating to the merger that we've incurred so far. And finally, £4 million in total of amortisation and impairments. We also incurred £7 million of interest on the £100 million bond that we issued in March of 2015. As the merger is expected to complete well before the just retirement record date of the 6th of May, partnership shareholders of JRP at that date will be entitled to the JR interim dividend of 1.1p per share declared today. That is, of course, subject to the agreed merger ratio of 0.834 JR shares for each partnership share. Now looking at MCEV, in total it increased by £57 million, or roughly 10%, to £633 million at the end of the year. The main items driving this were £30 million of new business value generated during the year, representing a new business value margin of 4.8% post-expenses. £53 million of net proceeds from the Q3 equity raise, and that was offset by £28 million of investment variances, which, as I mentioned earlier, were primarily as a result of the asset portfolio optimization in the run into Solvency II. As the number of shares during the year increased as a result of the equity raise, the MCEV per share remained flat at 144 pence. Now moving on to capital, let's start with the economic capital position for partnership. Since implementation of Solvency II in January, this is no longer the overriding capital constraint for the business, but it remains important because it reflects our best estimate view of the liabilities, risks, and economic drivers of the business. Our economic capital position increased from 159% to 224% at the end of the year. This significant increase reflects £53 million from the equity raise in September, and also reflects the fact that we've been able to release excessive prudence previously carried in the economic capital balance sheet. That mainly relates to credit defaults and property volatility, which resulted from the parameters being carried over from the ICAS regime into our economic capital calculation previously. We are now calculating our economic capital basis on our true best estimate view of the world, and capital is held to cover our own view of 1 in 200-year stresses. On the right of the page, we set out the impact of various stresses on the economic balance sheet, and you can see that even in extreme stresses, the capital position remains very well covered. In case you're wondering, it's worth flagging that for the property stress, we show such low relative sensitivity to a 35% fall in property values because in our base balance sheet, we already assume properties are overvalued by 28%. So we have inbuilt prudence in the balance sheet already. On the next page, we set out the Solvency II position for partnership. As you can see on the chart on the left here, we had own funds of £585 million and an SCR of £407 million, giving a surplus at year-end of £178 million. This represents a coverage ratio of 144%. This is a capital position which the board is comfortable with. I'll come on to the sensitivities in more detail shortly, which show how resilient the capital position is under those stresses. Importantly, and like JR, our own funds is high-quality capital, primarily comprising Tier 1 capital, and is largely made up of net worth rather than the present value of future profits. I'll step through this in more detail shortly. And just as a recap on the right-hand side, you can see that our Solvency II calculation is prepared on a standard formula basis. The calculation also reflects approvals received from the PRA to use matching adjustment and transitional measures. This slide builds a high-level bridge between the economic capital and Solvency II position. You can see some material differences which explain the move from 224% on an economic basis to 144% under Solvency II. The main differences between the own funds calculation under two bases are, firstly, differences in the calculation of liabilities, for example, due to having to use the matching adjustment restrictions under Solvency II. Secondly, the impact of the risk margin, which is required to be held on a Solvency II basis, but which there is no equivalent concept on an economic capital basis. And finally, the benefit of transitional measures, which partially offsets those two factors. In terms of the capital requirements, there are numerous differences, such as assumptions on default rates. These differences are as a result of the calculations being prescribed on a Solvency II standard formula basis, rather than them being based on our own best estimates, as is the case on the economic capital. Now, this slide sets out the composition of our own funds. As you can see on the left, the vast majority of our own funds is made up of Tier 1 capital. Just 17% of the own funds is Tier 2 capital, which is the £100 million bond that we issued in March of last year. So there's clearly capacity within the current structure to raise further Tier 2 capital if desired. Similar to Just Retirement, Partnership has also got a relatively low gearing compared to the sector. As a percentage of our MCEV, it is around 16%. Compared to an industry sector average gearing, which is typically in a range of 25 to 30%. If we increased our gearing to be in line with the sector average, you would see the Solvency II capital coverage ratio increasing by between 14 and 22 percentage points. Now turning to the sensitivity of the Solvency II position, as you can see from the chart above, the position is resilient even under stress scenarios. Solvency II is, of course, our overriding capital constraint since January 1st this year, but for making individual business decisions, it doesn't necessarily always provide a good economic view of the business. As a result, we believe economic capital, which reflects our own best estimate of the liabilities and risks, is still relevant. For example, the property stress that we present here right on the right-hand side shows that following a 20% fall in property prices, the impact on the coverage ratio will be negligible. This is because for standard formula, the risk on equity release business is required to be captured under the spread risk module. So if Solvency II standard formula were the only tool used in decision making, it could lead to uneconomic decisions. Therefore, we'll be taking a more balanced view between the two. That brings me to the end of my section, so I'll hand you back to Rodney for final comments.
Thanks, David. As you've seen from earlier slides, despite the merger discussions, we have been focused in both companies on maintaining business as usual momentum and have delivered on that. And that makes up the first two parts of the enlarged group's future equity story. And firstly, as we've outlined, there's still attractive market segment called individual GIFLs. Medically underwritten GIFL continues to represent better value for retirees. And so when we are able to compete in the open market, when customers choose to shop around, we have in JRP a better chance to win that business. And by the way, clearly recent share market volatility has become a stark reminder to investors and their advisors of the risks of depending solely on drawdown. As for DB, of course, rightly much has been written about it by you guys in the room, and there remains a substantial opportunity in this market. The medically underwritten DB de-risking segment is now well established. Thanks also to LNG for participating there. That is going to further entrench this as a legitimate methodology for which we have a competitive advantage. We will encourage small and medium enterprises to participate in medical underwriting in order to deliver superior outcomes for themselves and also to top slice for larger schemes. And we clearly have demonstrated an ability to enter a new marketplace and quickly capture meaningful share. As Simon has shown, we are comfortable with the capital positions of the companies under Solvency II. There certainly has been an increase in capital requirements under Solvency II, and there has been some dislocation in the marketplace as a result. Indeed, some larger insurers have signaled that they may deploy their capital elsewhere. We happen to see that as an opportunity and have already started to see prices respond and adjust as a result. Both of our companies have shown real agility in adapting to the post-budget pensions world since March of 2014. We have both introduced leading platform-based drawdown solutions where we have incorporated an element of guaranteed income, and these are complementary to the drawdown funds rather than competing. Of course, GIFLs come into their own for customers in their mid to late 70s, and we see that as a growing market segment following the removal of the age 75 rule in 2011. Partnership, as David has indicated, had launched into the care market in the US and is rolling out to 48 states. Initial rollout on the 22nd of February to 13 states will be followed up. And we are optimistic given the significant size of the US market. And can I remind you that this is a much lighter capital consumptive product with more attractive margins. And through our combined outstanding intellectual property, we will be well placed to participate in any UK secondary annuity market, which is due to be launched from April 2017. So quickly moving on to the merger, we are confident that we've created a robust plan for delivering the integration synergies that we've confirmed to you today. and at the same time continuing to manage growth and development of the new combined business. The integration planning has been well progressed, and we intend to hit the ground running in early April on completion of the merger. We have a joint integration committee which has been active, and we now have a 100-day plan fully developed to launch when the time comes. I would like to pause there and pay tribute to the significant efforts and professionalism of the staff in both of our companies during what, as you can well imagine, is a time of some uncertainty for the people. Now, after June and well into our 100-day plan, we should be able to share with you and show the benefits of the cost-saving program, and that will be our focus from April. Because of the significant value of the synergies, just looking at those again, we remain confident of achieving at least $40 million of cost savings, with the full run rate being achieved in the 2018 year. The chart that you see in front of you shows that those savings are distributed across the full cost base of our overlapping businesses, and we intend to leave no stone unturned in terms of pursuing cost efficiencies. Of course, it is early days, and we can't be specific about the particular savings until we've addressed those with the individual people involved in the business. But let me assure you, given the slight delay to our planning, that that has enabled our team to have more advanced plans for April. The $40 million is actually material, given the cost base of each of the companies, and we will keep you abreast of progress as we achieve those savings. Coming to a conclusion, so on the 10th of March yesterday, we announced that approval had been received from the remaining two regulators. Of course, given the fact that we were proposing a merger at the very same time as the introduction of a brand new regulatory regime from the 1st of January, that has added a layer of complexity that perhaps would not be there in future or in the previous past. But we have successfully cleared those hurdles, and we intend to issue our shareholder circular shortly. That will then be followed by shareholder meetings towards the end of March and a court hearing to approve, should the shareholders vote in favour, the scheme of arrangement. Our results in both sales and profit look strong in all the right places, and of course the outlook for us remains positive, particularly in the DB market. And it is interesting to note that between us, we are currently completing, on average, one DB deal a week. So the combined group completed 51 deals, as you saw in 2015. It's also encouraging to see the GIFL market has been improving as well. I am confident that as JRP, we can produce superior results compared with what either of our individual companies could have achieved on its own. Thirdly, we are comfortable, as we have indicated, with our Solvency II ratios being at a sensible level, which will enable us to achieve our sales plans. And that is especially so given the resilience to market movements, as you've seen, and the capital management tools that will be available to us in the future. So we are looking forward to the new combined JRP business with a sound balance sheet and attractive market segments to participate in. And we look forward to seeing you again in the near future to share with you how we are progressing. So I would now like to pass to questions, and Shane, if you would also come to the front. We will start with questions from the floor and then towards the end, questions on the phone. Yes. There's the roving mic coming.
Thanks very much. Thanks, Gordon Aitken from RBC. Firstly, on the debt, I mean, you mentioned that you've got the possibility to raise some debt. I'm wondering, are you feeling any pressure to raise some debt, and where would that pressure coming from? Is it internal? Is it shareholders? Is it the regulator? Second question on the top slicing market. How do you see that developing? Do you see that being actually a bigger driver in the future than complete schemes? And you know, what are the consultants saying on this? And finally, just on the step change in pricing due to Solvency II, I'm just wondering, I mean, one of your big competitors is saying that the risk margin now is now the impact of that means, that obviously this is without reinsurance, but means that the capital requirement is up to sort of 20 to 25% of the reserve. So if you can sort of maybe give an example, so you've got maybe a scheme last year, the liabilities were 100%, maybe you were pricing at 110%. What would that be now under Solvency II? Thank you.
I'll start with the defined benefit. Shane, if you can be ready to answer the question on the 25% capital, which we don't recognise, by the way. But firstly, to the debt, we have indicated into the past that we would continue to explore all avenues in terms of an efficiency in terms of our balance sheet. So we are comfortable with the Solvency II ratios. We can continue to deliver our planned sales plan from this point. We believe that as a combined group, we intend to review our reinsurance arrangements across both groups because they're not at the same level. And we will also have prospective access as a bigger combined group to the debt capital markets because as shareholders, we believe our shareholders will wish us to have the most efficient balance sheet. So we are comfortable, as you've just seen, and just to explain clearly the delay, because I appreciate a number in the room have wondered why we didn't get approval or didn't move ahead in December. Just to be clear, when you think back, it is quite logical. The companies lodged an application for change in control in June-July period, and of course that was on a Pillar 2 basis with very early sight of Solvency II. We received our internal model approval on the 5th of December, and Partnership received final standard formula approvals in January. And the regulator quite naturally wished us to present our five-year future plans on a Solvency II basis. So it was only after receiving both of those approvals that we could rerun all of the future projections submitted to the regulator. To be fair to them, they have been relatively busy. They have delivered for us this week. So they, in approving that, have approved it on the ratios that you see before us. But of course, we quite rightly as a management team should pursue balance sheet efficiencies, and if we did achieve debt raising at some point in the future, it would enable us to further accelerate our growth. On the DB front, we intend to, Gordon, continue to focus on the small and medium enterprise end of the market, where we do see a competitive space for ourselves, and we have actually created quite an industrialized process. As I said, we've achieved more than 50 deals and processed them in the year, and by definition, that's probably more deals than some of the other bigger established players, but it's gaining our reputation and strengthening our relationships with EBCs. There is no denying that from the 1st of January, with respect to new business, Solvency II has increased the capital requirement, as the risk margin is a significant new element that was not part of Pillar 2. But Shane, can you just comment on the change?
Yeah, absolutely. If we take the base capital requirement, whilst there's an awful lot of noise and movement between the different risk types in the Solvency II environment, broadly speaking, we would still see capital requirement of around about the 10% mark, maybe slightly less, based on a mixture of 25% equity release mortgage alongside the annuities. The risk margin is of the order of 5%, so it is effectively like another 50% of capital, again, compared to what we were used to. So we would recognize a number of maybe around 15, but that is benefiting firstly from the reassurance that we've now got in place on both the score, both the GIFLs and the DB. But more importantly, it's benefiting from the diversification benefit and high yield that we get from the lifetime mortgages that are in that mix. So without that, I would hazard a guess that we would probably see something of at least 20%. So the number that you've quoted is certainly not beyond the realm of belief. And without any reassurance, it would definitely top 25. In terms of pricing, though, of course, it's not typical for an insurance company to actually throw the entire amount of the capital into the price, but to charge for the cost of holding that capital. But the problem with the risk margin is very, very long tail runoff. And therefore the cost of that capital on any sensible set of assumptions is actually a significant proportion of the capital itself. So unfortunately, customers are likely to see and are already seeing price increases broadly equal to the amount of the risk margin. So individual GIFL prices have moved. If you take all the noise of interest rates and everything out, they've moved since probably early December by about 4 or 5% in the market. And that is precisely... to say the impact of the risk margin.
Right, next question. Sandra.
It's Andrew Queen, is Autonomous. Can I take on a little bit from that, the financing side? Because as you roll forward, you're going to be releasing margins on old business, which benefits from transitionals, but having to finance new business with this sort of full 15% backing just to reach 100%. I mean, presumably it'd be over 20% if you want to maintain the 150 coverage. So what level of growth can you maintain or self-fund? Because that, I think, is the key issue here. Secondly, could you talk a little bit about the DB market? You've got, I think, in that sort of small segment of below 150 million, you've got about 25% market share, and there's new players coming into that market the whole time. So whether you think you can continue to grow share there. And then finally, I think on partnership, you said something about you rejigged your corporate bond portfolio so that more you could get the matching adjustment. Could you tell us, what had you not done that, what would have been the impact on your capital requirement?
Well, if we start, David, with the last one, that's very specific, a short response to
that. Yeah, it was a bit, it's more binary than that, Andrew. There's certain tests you got to meet to actually qualify for the matching adjustment. So a lot of the optimization and changing of the corporate bond portfolio to ensure that we met all the matching adjustment criteria. So it wasn't a question of it could have been X or Y million pounds worth. It's just that you wouldn't have met the matching adjustment criteria if you didn't tick all the boxes.
In our case there, of course, we have established special purpose vehicles both for our mortgages and our callable bonds, so that we can create matching adjustments through that mechanism, and that was part of our internal model approval. Coming to the DB market, we started from zero. We've invented a new market together. We've captured a 10% share of the entire DB de-risking market. As you say, we're 25%. We actually welcome the other competitors because that's added to the legitimacy. As David said, it's gone from 3% medical underwriting to 10% to 15%. We sincerely believe that if trustees are appropriately encouraged to see that as legitimate, that will become bigger, and that's where we have the competitive advantage over the the people that you say will compete with us. In the end, we would like to see a bigger cake. We believe that the DB market can continue to grow. The combined size of our business, of course, enables us to better do the top slicing deals. As you could see in the charts, partnership completed one for 206 million on just 100 lives. We intend to continue to be active in that space. And the bigger capability of the group means we can probably write schemes of that size. There are 4,800 schemes in our small and medium enterprise target market. And as I said, we were happy to do 50. I don't want to calculate how many 50s in 4,800, but there's enough to keep us going and give an opportunity for future expansion. I think it is important, David, if you would talk about delivery against the sales plans, and is there a limit to our growth, I think Andrew is asking.
Yes, so it's not possible at this stage to provide precise guidance on these things because, as Shane mentioned, there's a number of inputs to the price in the market which are moving. And whilst we are seeing a discernible increase in price in the GIFL or the retail annuity market, the data points on the DB side are fairly scant at this stage because it's been, you know, not a lot of transactions in the first quarter of this year. I would observe that there's evidence that prices are firming up in the DB market, but it would be difficult to put a figure on that at this stage. So what we can say is that both boards are comfortable with their capital positions, and as we put together our business plan for the new organization, we're comfortable that we can support those with our current capital base. What we do have, though, as a bigger organization, is the opportunity to, frankly, play with more tools in the capital management toolkit. We've talked already about, for example, possibly accessing the debt capital markets. With a bigger balance sheet, the capacity to do that is obviously stronger. We also have a much bigger assets under management as a combined organization, so there may be opportunities there to drive capital efficiencies. And finally, reinsurance strategy is an area where, as a combined group, again, we think we both have good relationships with reinsurers at the moment, but we're an even more attractive partner to work with as a larger business. And all those tools, I think, open the potential to accelerate the growth and go beyond what we're currently planning. Exactly what it translates into number depends on exactly how hard you can pull those levers and exactly where the market clearing price is in a post-Solvency II world. But there's plenty of ground for optimism there.
Perhaps I could just follow that up. I think what we want is some sort of clarity, because partnership before was not self-funding from in terms of the new business. And in this new world, the financing of new business is more expensive. And I think we need to get some clarity, probably not today, but some clarity as to what level of business, new business, this company can self-fund while being self-sustaining in terms of coverage ratios and paying a decent dividend.
Yeah, I think the way we will do that is, for example, exactly how the new company wants to manage its capital is a matter for the board of the new company, which hasn't formally formed yet. So we will develop that capital management policy for the new company, and we will come back with further guidance on that front in due time.
So our board is keen that we present to shareholders an investor day around June, and we should be able to give an update on our 100-day integration plan, but also the board will have established its capital risk appetite by that point. Yes.
Oliver Steele at Deutsche Bank. I'm going to keep on this subject, I'm afraid. We'll see how far we can get. Shane, thank you very much for providing some guidance on the funding costs. But actually, coming back to Andrew's point on how much capital you're actually generating in year one to fund that, I think this is actually quite an important thing. So can you give some sort of guidance as to, under the new regime, how you think you're covering that initial funding cost in year one? That's question one. Question two is, can you talk a little bit more about the sort of reinsurance arrangements that you're planning in the new regime? Because I think they're changing from the previous type of reinsurance. And then thirdly, partnership and JR seem to have opposing sensitivities to credit spreads. Does that make you basically completely neutral to credit spreads, or what's happening there?
Shane.
Yeah. Okay.
Quickly on reinsurance. And
Let me deal with the reinsurance one first. It's clear that we've had different approaches between the two companies in the past. We've had reinsurance that was predominantly financing with sort of 7 or 8 year temporary risk cover. And we have already been switching for 3 years now to full-blown risk transfer through longevity swaps, as we said, whereas I believe David can explain more, but there's always been more of a focus on risk transfer there. Whereas we've tended to spend more of our risk budget, if you like, on the longevity. There's clearly a great opportunity as we put the two together to come up with a blended approach and pick the sweet spot between the two. There's also the great advantage of having two separate sets of reassurers that we can continue to use both of and use as a form of panel and get better, therefore hopefully better deals from. There's a lot of work to do. To be honest, but expect to see something that is probably somewhere between the two that you see at the moment. On the funding, if I can just deal with one of Andrew's questions very quickly, because it is relevant. You're quite right that the transition all has to be paid for, effectively, as it runs off over 16 years. But that's a bit of a red herring, because it's self-funding, because it's there in the first place to cover some of the areas of prudence in the new regime and give 16 years of relief against that. So unless you believe that those areas of prudence really are going to turn into claims, they actually emerge as margins in profit over the same period. So it is effectively self-funding. And to give some comfort on that, in order to get the transitional relief, companies have had to produce what are called phasing in plans. So we had to do 25-year closed fund and 5-year open fund projections for the regulator to prove that it was self-funding and that there would be no strain arising from the transitionals disappearing. So that's been covered off in the process, effectively. In terms of where the money comes from, Oliver, that's obviously difficult to quote exact numbers because prices move all the time. But essentially, it comes from the margin in the profit in the product. With the sort of margins that we see, if I can use old-fashioned EV stuff a bit, with the margins that we see running at the 40, 50% mark on the mortgages, provided the annuities are effectively more or less break even in old terminology, and then if you include the additional pricing that we are hoping will stick in the market for individual, and as David says, to be tested in DB, that should cover the risk margin, and then the combination of a roughly break even plus 25% of 40 to 50 gives you the 10% capital requirement. So that's why I've always said it broadly washes his face, but don't ask me on any particular day, because it depends on exactly what the price of the two products is. But that's where the money comes from.
Perhaps other companies haven't talked about the repayment of the transitionals, so that might be... Might be some new news.
Sorry, you've got my credit question.
The credit. What? One of them's going up, one of them's going down. I think the real issue is you cannot compare an orange with an apple.
Yeah, and that's, I think, a more general comment than just the credit spread sensitivities. When you look at the Solvency II sensitivities of the two companies, you've got to recognize that the Just Retirement's prepared on an internal model basis, and ours are all on a standard formula basis. So to take your particular example on credit spreads, when credit spreads widen, that effectively gets passed straight through to the matching adjustment as a standard formula firm, because the fundamental spread, which is deducted off actual spreads, is averaged over 30 years. So spreads widening out tomorrow makes negligible difference to the matching adjustment. So what you actually see flowing through is a reduction in the SCR in our numbers, which is why the Solvency II surplus increase. So the own funds is roughly unchanged. The SCR goes down, which means your Solvency II surplus increases.
I'd like to just... One last question here, and then we'll check on the phone if there's someone.
Morning, John Hockney from Morgan Stanley. I've got three questions, please. Just on the SPVs that have been set up, to what extent does that require you to effectively tranche investments over time? And does that mean that you end up with some seasonality to the new business margin? Because we can actually put the assets into those SPVs on a revolving basis. And then secondly, what is this sort of spread give up for the cost of the SPV? And then finally, just to come back on the capital generation point, so are you arguing that the 10% base capital requirement hasn't changed, the risk margin is 5% for you, and are those numbers, are they net of reassurance or gross of reassurance? I'm just trying to understand that the 4% to 5% price increase, I'm not sure how that gets you back to self-funding, because I'm not so familiar with the JR numbers, but I seem to remember for partnership, it used to be 10, 12% gross margin, about 5-6% net margin, and then net of the reassurance, you were getting it down to about 7% capital requirements, just sort of washing its face. Can you walk through those numbers?
Right. So just quickly, given the time, if I cover the first two and Shane, you do the base capital. So you'll recall the Paul Fisher letter here in the UK proposing a methodology for internal model firms to handle the mortgage business because, given lifetime mortgages, you don't know precisely when the customer is going to die and repay the mortgage. So we've established a special purpose entity. It is an internal special purpose entity, so there is no loss of value from the company. It's not a third party provided by a bank or something outside. So there's no loss of long-term value, and it creates notes that give a standard maturity and coupon, and we can structure those to best suit the liabilities. That is one of the critical points. We can actuarially construct them. We have a monthly revolving process of new mortgages created in the month, turned into notes based on a demand from the actuarial team on the liabilities they've taken in during the month. So we can construct the notes specifically to best match, and then buy the balance of bonds from the market. So that is working. You are subject to the fundamental spread under EIRPA rules because they're then notes. But the key message is there's no loss of economic value because it's an internal entity. Shane, just quickly on the base capital requirements and risk margin.
Yeah, let me try to do it in a slightly different way. I've used 10 just to keep it simple, but as I said at the beginning, that the capital is probably anywhere between 8 and 10, and it depends on the mix of the three products for us. And also, I would say that you can't translate anything I say directly into what David may have said in the past, because he's tended to talk in the past in terms of IFRS margins, whereas we tend to talk in terms of something that's closer to an EV world. Or at least I do. Simon talks about both languages. So if we said that it was a 8% and then 5% risk margin, then you've got 13 or maybe upwards to 15 in terms of the total capital requirement. In the past, of course, we have been using the financing reassurance. That's the other element that I missed out, that was providing maybe 3% of the capital. And we are looking at ways to make that work in the Solvency II world. But putting that to one side, as I say, the first point is that we have raised prices by 5 to get rid of the risk margin part effectively. So that means we've got to cover the 8 to 10. And broadly speaking, that is where the EV margin of the two products combined would have been. I probably confused things before by trying to talk about the two separately, which we haven't really done in the past. But essentially, when you combine 25%. Mortgages with the annuities that you write, and provided you're pricing at sensible levels, as we have done on average over the last 2-3 years, you will get that sort of margin, 7-8%, sufficient to cover it.
And of course, the other benefit of the combined JRP group is that partnership has a more mature book with a much larger care component. So the capital releases for the combined group will make us more capital effective. Could you just please check whether there's someone on the phone, since they normally miss out?
Otherwise, Barry, you'd like to ask a question.
Your
First question comes from the line of Kunal Zaveri from JP Morgan. Please ask your question.
Yeah, hi. Good morning, everyone. This is Ashik Musadi from JP Morgan. I'm just on Kunal's line, but just a couple of questions. First of all, a simple question is, what is the fundamental spread charge at the moment under Solvency II in your own fund? So that's the first question. And second one, a bit more complicated question, I agree. How should we think about the ROE on the new business? So what I'm trying to understand here is, what is the spread you're making and how much of the equity you need to put in for new business? Now, clearly, when we are talking about the denominator of 10%, 15%, or say 25%, depending on different reinsurance scenarios, a part of that would be covered by VIF, value of in-force. But if we just think about how much of the capital you need to set aside in terms of hard equity, what is the spread we are making, assuming there is no change in the pricing? Yeah, so any thoughts on these two questions would be great.
Given the time, Shane, just quickly on the fundamental spread, and David, if you can have a go on the return of capital, but I suspect it is not a methodology that either company currently presents under, so that will be a greater challenge.
Yeah, for once you got me on this one, I'm afraid. The fundamental spread actually varies by six different credit quality steps and for every single year of duration, so there's a huge number of assumptions, and they change every month, I'm afraid. So I can't quote you the exact number. I would guess on average it's probably around 60, 70 basis points, but I would want to come back and confirm that.
That's the range I would have given as well.
Thank you.
Right, and as Roddy mentioned, historically neither company has focused on return on capital metrics on new business because new business at the margin has either washed its own face or been close to washing its own face. These are new metrics that we're going to have to develop for the new world. The numbers that Shane just stepped through do tell you that actually a lot of the capital strain can be funded through new business margins. But exactly how much of it is left needs to be required by an investment of capital does depend ultimately on where the prices are clearing in the new world. Which itself will not be a set number. It will vary around depending on competitive pressures. So what we will aim to do, we come back, is give you a bit more guidance on that, what the type of ranges might be on new business and what some of the key drivers are.
Very last question. I know you guys are, and it is quite a dichotomy between two companies coming together for a more successful future, and you're all dying to go and hear about one that's going to split itself into various pieces. But Barry, please.
Barry Gordon at Samuel Gordon. Three relatively simple ones, I think. First of all, just to clarify, Rodney, I think I know what you meant, but your very first question from Gordon talked about the balance sheet. I think you said you look to explore all avenues to strengthen it. I take it that's just in terms of the debt market rather than the equity market. Just clarify that one for me. The next one was you haven't talked about really South Africa, and touched on the US, just trying to get a time scale when we all start thinking something positive about those areas. And the last question, really in terms of the secondary annuity market, which could be coming, just wonder, there's a lot of talk in the trade press about mis-selling and nervousness on behalf of IFAs. Just wonder if you think there's any potential danger as a carrier if you take part in that sort of...
Yes, thank you for the opportunity to be absolutely clear about capital efficiency. Here I'm talking about a complete review of reinsurance and the trade-off, and obvious reinsurers don't do things gratis, so we have to carefully look at the profit versus capital effectiveness. Yes, I am referring to access to the Tier 2 debt market, seeing JR is completely unlevered, and no, I wasn't thinking about equity at all. There'll be a third component in terms of hedging. So we will also, in a combined sense, look at what's the most appropriate hedging in terms of the capital efficiency. So that's what I meant by the three capital efficiencies. Can you talk quickly about timescales and US?
We with Genworth launched on the 22nd of February. As Roddy mentioned, the initial rollout across 13 states.
focused on the Eastern Seaboard and California. So we're at a stage where agents have or are going through training and are starting to contact leads. So it's very early days. But one of the most impressive things about Genworth is the extent of the distribution reach they have in the long-term care market. It's absolutely essential to their business model. So they've got great, great reach. The intention is obviously to test and learn the approach in what is essentially a new market in the U.S. For both ourselves and Genworth, and then to roll it out across. Currently, we're authorized to go in 48 of the 50 states, so we'll roll that out over the balance of the year.
So we'd like to reserve our firepower and come back and tell you when we've got some really good story on that. In terms of the secondary annuity market, we are strong supporters of the concept. It is critical for it to be effective on two important regulatory points. One, that the 100% guarantee from the Financial Services Compensation Scheme for annuities passes across to us as an investor in terms of the credit capital that we would require in the investment. And secondly, that there is a high level of correlation in terms of our underwritten longevity risk capital. Because from our perspective as an underwriter, and this is where we have a competitive advantage, we would be using our intellectual property and underwriting system to value a customer coming to us exactly as we do for customers we are paying out money. So if a potential customer wishes to sell their annuity to us, we would underwrite them medically on exactly the same terms as we would underwrite a new customer of that same age, et cetera, for paying the money out. And if we can get that correlation, we see this as a very attractive asset class. Because a complete, there isn't a, if you can sell me a BP bond that's got longevity hedging in it, that's AAA, then, and it gives a good yield, I'll buy that. So we see it as an attractive opportunity, Barry, but there's a lot of work to be done with the regulator, and on the FCA side of things, there is a lot of work to be done in terms of the advice proposition, creating a bureau, which we could provide to the market, because we believe in, as you know, we own a company called the Open Market Annuity Service, which is a leading broker of open market annuities, and we could offer that type of bureau concept, because we do believe customers have to be quoted an open market price for their concept. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for your interest. As you can see, a great set of results, and we're looking forward to delivering for you some increased shareholder value from the combination of our companies, and all the best with your next meeting.